Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you once again to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and available on all major podcast platforms. So this week, I'm going to talk about monster. Seems like a very harsh and excessive word. It was about a man who spent most of his life writing and editing comic books. All of the degree that he did the writing is, as we'll see, controversial. But I'll leave it to listeners to decide whether this term applies or not. But certainly a controversial figure. I'm talking, of course, of Stan Lee, who lived one of the great American lives in many ways. Born of Jewish immigrant parents in 1922, lived to almost a century, dying in 2018. And during the course of the life, he started off at an industry that was really the bottom of the barrel of the cultural industries, which is the sort of comic book industry that grew up in New York in the 1930s, working for a publisher that was, not known for its highest ethical standards or treatment of employees, known at the time as Time Lee, and producing work that was, widely despised as really the bottom of the barrel stuff sold to children for 10 cents. But over the course of his life, became the kind of face of a company that later changes things to Marvel Comics and was the producer of the major superhero comic book characters of the 1960s, such as the Fantastic Four, the Hulk, the X-Men, Black Panther, and many more. And these characters became the basis for a global cultural phenomenon, the one that eventually conquered Hollywood. So this is a major American life and a story well worth telling. And it was told recently in a documentary released by Disney. And that documentary is causing a lot of controversy because the way that it told the story, a lot of people feel is not quite fully honest, let's say. So to talk about Lee, his legacy, and also especially his collaborators, and I'll mention the artists Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko as the major ones. To discuss Stan Lee and his legacy, I'm very happy to have Elana Levin. They have published widely about comics in places like The Daily Beast, and they host the podcast Graphic Policy Radio, which really gets into the nitty-gritty of the intersection of comics and politics and public policy, even. And they've written especially about Lee and his collaborators, particularly Jack Kirby. So I'm very happy to have Elana on. And let's start. Let's start with the documentary. What did you think of the documentary?
Well, it shows my dedication and respect for your work that I watched it, because I was very grateful to have had other critics watch it so that I would not have to. But because you invited me on, I said, okay, I'll watch the beginning of this documentary. I made it through about the first 35 minutes. I feel like I got the gist. Mm-hmm. It's so bad. And I don't think that it's, parts of it are bad storytelling and parts of it are bad because it's not true. I thought that the device of using sort of dolls and dioramas to illustrate some pieces of the story is the kind of thing that, I like the Todd Haynes documentary, the film, the Karen Carpenter story, it can be a fun technique. It felt a little bit random in dealing with Stan Lee, but more so, I felt like all of the stories from his early childhood were so plug and play. He's the same generation as my grandparents. He's the same ethnic group as my mm-hmm. grandparents, though you would not know from listening to anything he said. But the stories felt so completely literally any white person of immigrant heritage living in the Eastern Seaboard would have had exactly the same anecdotes of their early childhood. And maybe if you're of a young generation where your grandparents are baby boomers, this would be a new story for you to hear. But to most of us, it was come on, guys, give me something. But I think it speaks to, in some ways, the way he has generalized and mythologized his own life, that his early childhood stories were so deeply generic. And, like, I understand he converted later, but it's bizarre to me to have someone not say they were raised in a Jewish household. It's just bizarre to me.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, and especially in the context of the sort of, you know, comic book industry that he emerged from in the 30s and 40s, which was, you know, like a very heavily immigrant dominated industry, as one would expect from something in New York, particularly that was very working class. So there were a lot of people who are either Jewish immigrants or the children of Jewish immigrants or the children of Italian immigrants.
Yeah.
It was not a very, you know, a WASP industry at all. Like, and so I think that, and, you know, other documentaries and other books that have written about this, you know, like, do play up the facts. So it is part of, I think you're right to key on this issue of reinvention. You know, he is someone who reinvented himself, and that's not unique to him. I mean, I think, you know, that might be true of many of the people that became involved with comic, but I think he reinvented himself with a particular vigor in terms of creating a public persona. And this documentary takes that public persona, like, almost at face value. And maybe we should talk about, like, why that would be a problem. So the very first statement that is in the documentary is a clip from 1966. And I was, like, kind of stunned that it starts with a lie. Because in that statement, he says that, you know, the Marvel Comics Group is the biggest publisher of comics in the world. And, like, if you, we actually have, like, pretty good numbers on, like, you know, what comics were selling, because all the publishers had to register with the post office to sell subscriptions. And, like, Marvel Comics in 1966, they were selling, you know, not just far less than Batman and Superman. They were selling less than Archie. And they were selling less than, like,
of course,
you know, and Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck. I mean, like, they were still, like, but you know, so but I mean, leaving alone that this is just the United States, like, you know, there were comics in Japan. They were selling much more. But for someone, I mean, that's a promotional clip. He's a salesman. Of course, you're going to say we're the best selling. And in a lot of ways, like, you know, Lee was a very American BS artist, you know, like a type of figure that we're all familiar with. But so, I mean, that's a little lie. But the big lie that the documentary kind of follows through is his account of the origin and creation of Marvel. And this is an account that he gave many times in many interviews, as well as some books that he, you know, allegedly he put his name on, and and essays that he put his name on. But I mean, basically the story is, you know, he had spent two decades as a sort of hack writer. His was dissatisfied. His wife said, you know, why don't you just write what you want? And then he decided to pursue that with an idea he came up with, which is the Fantastic Four. And then later he was sitting on a sofa and he saw a fly in the wall, and that encouraged him to create Spider-Man. And then he, like, went on and created many other characters. And in creating them, he was assisted by people who carried out his vision. And that was the artist Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. He would bring them the ideas. And he's very grateful for the way that they were able to bring his ideas to life. Now, that is the main kind of narrative that is being told. Well, what do we think of the story?
It's just not true. And it's bizarre. Again, it's bizarre. But, like, people have repeated this as Pat, you know, and this documentary, which is literally propaganda for Disney, you know, for whom the story of Lee as this sole genius who's no longer alive to say anything different, who invented all of their characters, for whom nobody else should have any creative license, it suits their commercial needs entirely. And it's just thoroughly debunked by any historian doing work on this, but based on the words of anybody else who was alive, who wasn't economically benefiting by Stan Lee pretending he invented this and that the artists were just operating as his hands. It is so glaringly at odds with real history. And I feel like the fact the documentary doesn't even cite what interviews are from what almost plays into this idea that this is this whole story that exists as truth, as myth, but has no, like that clip you said it began with, they don't cite it. They don't cite this interview. And as a documentary, they know what these interviews are from. They know what the sound is from. But yeah, I was amazed at the degree to which they invisibilized the work of Ditko and Kirby. Like, I thought there would be at least a little more recognition and a little less lying, but no, No.
Yeah, no. I'm glad you mentioned this fact that this is corporate propaganda on behalf of Disney. Because we should mention, you know, these are issues on which there have been major lawsuits, some mm-hmm. of which have been settled and some of which are ongoing. And there's two aspects to this. One is that as long as Lee was alive, he was of great use to the various corporate owners of Marvel. The company that's known as Marvel went through many corporate iterations and is now owned by Disney. Through all these corporate changes, Lee was the kind of constant. Except for a little period of turmoil in the late 1990s, he basically worked for the company from 1939 until his death. And the reason he was able to hold on to a job is that he served the interests of the company, which is that he was the editor, say, you know, as management, I created these characters and the freelancers carried out my vision. And in lawsuits, that's a very useful figure to have. And as I mentioned, you know, like these lawsuits kind of continue. So you need to maintain this kind of myth. But there's a kind of secondary level of all this, which is that you also create a public persona, a sort of, you know, Walt Disney type figure, you know, or even more mythically, like a sort of Uncle Ben or type character, or Ronald McDonald's character, who's the sort of corporate figurehead. And, you know, like Lee made cameos in, you know, like dozens of Marvel movies and became a kind of public face of the company. And, you know, one could say, you know, there was once a biological human who took the name Stan Lee, but that creature died in 2018. But there was also a brand, and it's actually a trademark. The name Stan Lee and all the, you know, his associated traits were like trademarked and branded. And that brand actually continues to exist. It's actually owned. I don't think it's owned by Disney. So that's owned by another company, but they work with the, so somehow is this, like, you know, this corporate brand, this Ronald McDonald, who is existing to serve both the sort of legal and branding interests of Disney.
Yeah. Yeah. And with comics as a visual medium, doesn't it, if you step back, not pass the sniff test that a writer, editor who is not an artist is somehow the visionary behind these characters who predominantly exist as drawings? Like, that's, if you just take a minute, you're like, yeah, that does sound strange, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah, no, it really sounds strange. And I think that that's a good thing, opportunity to get into, you know, what we actually think happened and who are the actual, like, inspirations or, you know, like, the real hands that created the Marvel Universe. And, you know, it's also, I think they're actually, you know, like, it's a collaborative industry. There are many artists and inkers, but the two names that are, you know, often singled out quite properly are Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. And they were never employees in the way that Stan Lee was. They worked as sort of freelancers. But I want to, like, just talk about, you know, the figure of Jack Kirby a little bit, because he had an alternative narrative, and it's worth tracing out this narrative. You know, like, likely coming out of immigrant Jewish background, born Jacob Kurtzberg, likely a kind of reinvention, becoming Jack Kirby. Although I will note that Kirby, you know, A, never converted, and B, never sort of denied his Jewishness. And in fact, there are, like, very explicit Jewish themes in his work going back to the late 1940s. You know, where he did romance comics that are about intermarriage and discrimination. You know, going back and forward to the 1970s, where he created the work called The Fourth World, which is a kind of reimagining of the Bible in science fiction terms. But, you know, coming out of that immigrant Jewish background, coming to comics very early in 1941, co-creating with Joe Simon Captain America, which becomes a huge hit for the company that is owned by Stan Lee's relative, Martin Goodman, has a falling out. Simon and Kirby move to DC Comics, where they create the Boy Commandos, which becomes another huge hit. Serves in wartime, is, you know, in Europe, not on D-Day, but a few months later in the sort of battlegrounds of France. Returns to America with Joe Simon, you know, basically creates the genre of romance comics, which becomes the dominant kind of commercial form of comics in the late 1940s and 50s. And then in the sort of 50s, starts to struggle. The partnership with Simon breaks up because the comic book industry is under a lot of stress, partially due to a sort of cultural purge and then also to distribution problems. And then finds himself ending up back at Marvel Comics with Lee, someone he had, you know, last seen decades earlier when he was working on Captain America. And so Jack Kirby, you know, has this figure with a long history of creativity and coming up with ideas. I only mentioned a few of them. And then, you know, coming to Marvel, his story, and it seems plausible based on all his past record, is that he brought a lot of ideas to Marvel. And if you look at, I think one of the interesting things is if you look at the early Marvel, they're a fusion of everything that Kirby has done before. He did like sort of team books like Boy Commando. He did romance comics. He did Westerns. He did monster comics. And you look at something like the Fantastic Four, and it's a combination of, you know, like a science fiction adventure, which he did before, a romance comic, because there's a lot of like love triangles, a monster book, because one of the characters is a monster. And so like, just like if one looks at, even going beyond Lee Kirby's account, if one just looks at how these comics come together, it seems like what Marvel is Jack Kirby bringing everything that he had done before and fusing it together. But what do you think?
And like, literally he does the Challengers of the Unknown for DC, which has four very archetypal characters who three out of four like map to what he does with the Ones and the Fantastic Four, which is not to say that there aren't pieces or things that Stan brought to it. And I'll always tell people, like with Spider-Man, if Stan Lee had done nothing but write the words, "With great power also must come great responsibility," which I know is also a paraphrase of a famous philosophical statement, would be something. But that is not inventing all these characters yourself and treating these artists like they're just your hands and not brains as well. Yeah, like the launch of the Marvel Universe as we know it today is not just because Stan told Jack what to make. It's not. Yeah. And we have records, all the works from Ditko and from Jack. And the other pieces, if you look at what did each of these artists go on to make without each other, the creative track record of Jack Kirby without Stan Lee, yeah, and I'm not the first person to make this observation, but the creative work of Jack Kirby without Stan Lee is The Fourth World, which is one of the greatest works of fiction of all time. And Stan Lee's is Stripperella. Like, what is this? You know, I mean, Steve Ditko, like, is doing the, you know, writing The Question, and like, it's, you know, it's cool stuff. It's interesting, edgy stuff. Sorry, Steve Ditko is doing this edgy, interesting work by himself. And like, yes, Stan. Again, like if Stan was willing to speak the truth of his contributions, they would still be, he would still be management and the boss who screwed over his employees, but they would also be interesting and noteworthy. And the fact, and the fact that he won't just say like, "Hey, I was like this brilliant marketer who figured out how to make comics feel highbrow by talking about them in a highbrow way to help older audiences who had fallen in love with the work of Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko because they were making psychedelic artwork. I figured out a way to help them feel justified in their affection for these comics by telling the media that reading comics was smart." That's not a small cultural contribution, you know?
No, I'm really glad you said this all because, yeah, I mean, I think the documentary does a great disservice to Lee. And I think Lee's own mythologizing does a disservice because it actually undercuts what his actual achievement was. I think it's worth looking at, you know, as you say, what they did before and after. And in Lee's case, in the 40s and 50s, I mean, his real like major work or where he was really interested in was doing these kind of like Archie knockoffs for Marvel. But they had a lot of teen humor. And that seemed to be his natural default mode of going into sort of, you know, and he brought that to the Marvel comics in terms of like the dialogue that he added. And I think that, you know, that jokiness, which, you know, sometimes is irritating or whatever, but it is a distinctive kind of feature. But also he was an editor, right? And like and the work of editing is often invisible. So it's harder to explain to people what an editor does than what a writer does, right? But the work of editing of like, you know, like choosing who to hire, you know, what books to put out, how to promote them. I mean, that's all important stuff. And he created a persona. As we said, he reinvented himself. And the major character I will credit to Stan Lee is Stan Lee.
Here, here. I love it.
And the voice that he created is a distinctive one. And because that was the voice that was he was adding on to like all these books, it became a distinctive part of the Marvel. It knitted the Marvel universe together. And in fact, I think more than anyone else at Marvel, he helped it become a coherent universe. Like, I think like Kirby and Ditko and the other artists like Gene Colan and John Romita, they were building from the ground up. They were doing the sort of, you know, bottom up building of a universe story by story. But, you know, he was at the level of Stan Lee where one could see, he was, because he was writing the writing for not all, but many of these books, he was able to see it as a universe and knit it together. And I think he's actually the first one to use the phrase Marvel Universe, which it's up is like a major kind of thing, right? Everything we're saying is not to deny.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats, BEETS.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
That Stan Lee has a contribution. It's just like, it's a very different contribution than he himself claimed and that the movie gives to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But is there, I mean, what do you think of like those Marvel comics of the sort of 60s and then also the work that, you know, I mean, you mentioned the work that Kirby Ditko did later, because I think your voice is very interesting in this, because I think, unfortunately, a lot of the conversation is dominated by boomers who kind of read those comics when they first grew up. And I think that's created a distorting effect. And it's very interesting now to see, like, you know, younger people are coming to these comics, you know, without that sort of possessive memory and, you know, that ease of nostalgia and what they're kind of bringing to it. Because I think it's a very different kind of view. What are your thoughts on those comics?
You know, it's funny also because like the two contexts in which people will refer to me as a younger person are in context of the labor movement and in context of talking about Silver Age comics. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, I do talk to like younger people too, who also really do find something compelling and interesting in the work of Jack Kirby in particular. I think people find, I should speak for me. What attracted me to Jack Kirby's work was I grew up loving a lot of mid-century visual art and seeing all of that reflected in Jack Kirby's art in like a narrative storytelling, like fun kind of a story was so exciting to me. It was almost like, here is the psychedelic stuff that you like from the albums that you're listening to, you know, and I'm sure that's how it felt for young people of the day in that way. You know, here, like, you can see the Picasso and here you can see the, you know, like, you can like literally see cubism and all these pieces forming together in the visuals, but it's like in an exciting story. And the characters that he's creating, you know, there's a difference between like a charitable and an uncharitable reading of it can be sometimes. And if you're willing to go in and say, like, here's people who are trying to tell stories of diverse, complex people existing in a world that often hates and fears them in some cases, or doesn't understand what they're doing. I think that there's a lot of resonance for anybody who views themselves as being an outsider or different. And Stan, you know, certainly is someone who was talked about and played up, often to the point of lying about the intent behind certain stories that were created, but the utility of that, you know, what I would say about the fourth world is not what I would say necessarily about, like, you know, even the best Fantastic Four or Thor stuff. So I guess it sort of depends, like, which is it that you would want me to speak about here. But I think that's actually a very interesting kind of point to make, because I actually absolutely agree with it. Like, I would not necessarily class the two together. And there is a way in which, you know, like I came to all this stuff like sort of backwards. Like, when I first tried to read the Marvel comics of the 60s, I have to confess, like, I could not see what all the shouting was about. I mean, the art seemed obviously, like, you know, wonderful, as everybody says, like energetic, psychedelic, dreamy. But like, I, you know, when I would read the actual words, you know, there's a lot, it seemed like, as it was, like, you know, like a 40-year-old man trying to, you know, sound like a teenager and with all the sort of, you know, false use of slang and then often the kind of pretentiousness, as with like
you know, the Thor with the kind of mock Shakespearean language. And then also, like, you know, quite a bit of sexism with, like, you know, the way the character, like, Sue Richards, the Invisible Girl, it's kind of portrayed, not just in the sense, I mean, one could say, like, you know, Invisible Girl is actually, like, a pretty interesting commentary on, like, you know, sexism and the female role in society. And, you know, like, in some ways, I think in a sexist society, a female superhero would be an invisible girl.
Right.
But, like, you actually read the dialogue and then you get, like, oh, she's actually ditzy and she, like, totally adores her, like, a boyfriend who becomes her husband. And, and you know, like, so a lot of it seemed dated. Whereas, so I couldn't read a lot of the Marvel stuff. And then, but I, when I started to pick up the Fourth World stuff, like, it seemed like totally, like, sort of, like, you know, contemporary and sort of very, like, a very radical sort of commentary on the social changes that America was going through in the 60s and 70s. And that actually made me appreciate, like, go back to the 60s stuff and see the current of radicalism that was there, but that was kind of subsumed under the more mainstream writing. And I actually think, I mean, the way I see it and is that, like, sort of Kirby and Ditko were both kind of restrained by Stanley. They were able, you know, like, they're more radical impulses. And I can say we're kind of, you know, in Ditko's case, radical impulses that one, you know, could associate with the right, like with the sort of Randian vision, right? Of radical individualism. Well, but within Kirby's, you know, like a lot of, like, sympathy for the youth, sympathy for even the feminist movement. He has these great characters, the female Furies.
Yes. I mean, like, you know, like Jack Kirby is like, when he like is making up Black Panther, he's like, we want to have a black superhero from Africa and he has super science. And like, he isn't, you know, like, why not have Africa have super science? Like, why wouldn't, you know, why couldn't you have that be the story? Like, and just breaking out the idea that, like, we have to be like less, that African characters would be lesser than, you know, or like he's writing diverse characters into the story because he thinks it's exciting and cool. And, you know, sometimes there can be moments of tone deafness, I guess, but like the intent is always so clear. Like, you know, and I think one of the things we point to in terms of the difference between what Kirby is doing and what Stanley is writing over it, there's an amazing artist, analyst, Kate Willer, who has a series she's been writing called Kirby Without Words, where she removes the Stanley dialogue from the Jack Kirby pages. And you can see, oh my gosh, in this comic, like, Sue Storm is rescuing the Fantastic Four. And in that comic, Marvel Girl is rescuing X-Men. But then when you see what Stanley wrote over it, he's undermining every heroic, badass thing that these two women are doing for no reason. It's weakening the storytelling. It makes no sense. Like, the story that Jack wrote is very clear. You can see Marvel Girl is using her mental powers to free them from this trap. And for whatever reason, the reason is sexism, like, Stanley is writing over it how Professor X is telling her how to free them. Like, why? That's not shown in the images. Professor X isn't in the images. She's the one doing it. Why is he telling her what to do? This makes no sense. So it's undermining the storytelling that they're trying to do. And it's not necessary at all. It doesn't helping at all. And I think that, you know, when you mentioned what was alienating to you when you went back to look at the 60s work at Marvel, was this very dated dialogue that was written by Stan Lee. Like, was that adding stuff to you? Like, that wasn't it. You know, I mean, with something like Doctor Strange in that era, people are there are moments of funny wordplay and poetry in the dialogue, but like, you're not reading it for that. You're reading it because it's got really psychedelic art from Steve Ditko, of all people, right? But yeah, like, the stories that Jack Kirby is struggling to tell are being blocked by sexism and like weird racism and weird assumptions. I mean, they're not weird. They're like reflective of the society they exist in, but that he wasn't trying to hold or tell. I mean, you know, he's still a product of his time, but this is a guy who's progressive by the context of the day he's in, very much so in certain areas. And then when you see exactly in like Fourth World, which is Fourth World is a shorthand way to refer to Jack Kirby's comics that he produced for DC in the early 70s, which included Mr. Miracle, New Gods, the Forever People. And then he, because he didn't want to kick somebody off of their regular job he said, screw it, I'll do Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, since this comic doesn't have a regular writer. And he's writing these books and drawing them and basically editing himself. You know, Mike Royer is inking, and he is developing them into their own, like, capsule within the DC universe that is telling a story that goes between these four books, which is one of people, aliens and humans fighting against a fascist threat that is also Richard Nixon, that and showing how regular people have to be empowered, you know, should be empowered to help and fight back. And we should embrace people who are different from us, including people who are very strange to us, who also want to fight back. And it has really interesting female characters who are badass in it. It has the first Japanese superhero in it. I think he was predating any. I think Sonny Sumo was the first Japanese superhero in an American comic.
I'm not 100% sure, but that actually sounds right to me. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and Kirby is a, you know, a World War II veteran, and he's looking at the hippies around him and saying, oh my God, this is so cool, in a way that feels really genuine and not like he's like bandwagon writing, but he's like excited about this. And he's like doing stories about why the Vietnam War sucks, you know, through a metaphorical lens. And it's so, he's so in love with this changing and exciting world around him, and connecting it like to how he feels about fascism and Hitler, and like the bad guy is Richard Nixon from space. And it's one of the greatest works of fiction, I think, period. And he was doing it for DC Comics because Marvel wasn't giving him, because Stan Lee wasn't giving him the freedom or respect that he wanted. He wanted to tell this story of the New Gods and Thor. And Stan was like, yeah, but you can't do any of these things. You can't do any of these things.
Yeah, no,
DC was like, can we please give you money and we'll leave you alone? Of course, they did not fully leave him alone, but they left him alone more than Marvel did, you know?
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I'm really glad you said this, because I think, you know, I mean, this is like, obviously, as all aesthetics things kind of contested, and there are people who have preferred the Marvel comics of the 60s, but I've never felt that. Like, I have genuinely, like, you know, like, from the start, like, the Fourth World was my way into Jack Kirby, because it was, it is A, so fascinating, and B, like, once I knew the biography, like, it really feels like, you know, the work of a man liberated, like someone who had yes. to hold himself back for a long time. And, you know, like, now he's going to go for broke, and now he's going to tell everybody exactly, you know, like, you know, what his vision of the world is. And just politically, I mean, since you mentioned that, it is exactly an allegory of, you know, the political struggles of America at the time, which are the political struggles that are still going on. Mm-hmm. And some of it, like, very sort of prescient or very sort of timely, because part of the Richard Nixon, you know, space villain is he's allied with the sort of religious right. And there's a sort of figure based on Billy Graham called Glorious Godfrey, which is a kind of wonderful, you know, like, depiction of a kind of televangelist, you know, who leads people astray and, you know, uses the impulse of religion in an authoritarian way. Like, you know, those comics, like, they cut much deeper than the Marvel works of the 60s. Or I think that was, some of that stuff is in the Marvel work of the 60s, but you have to be an archaeologist to find it. Like, they're kind of like, you know, they're buried under a layer of someone else's dialogue and captioning.
Stan Lee. Let's think of they're buried under a layer of Stan Lee. The piece that I wrote that I think, you know, really, I guess, put me on the map for a lot of people as someone who is like deeply engaged with the works of Jack Kirby was the piece I wrote for Daily Beast about how Glorious Gottfried, this Billy Graham character in the Fourth World comics, is incredibly Trumpian. They both have very similar way of talking. They like to give people special hats to make them feel special, but the hats actually look stupid, but they're all like, we love our hats, they make us look special. And there's just, he looks like, he has physical similarities to Trump. It is uncanny, but he is really Trumpian in his approach to how he gets people to think about themselves and resign their freedom to him to make themselves feel better and more powerful, to revel in the pleasure of judging and condemning others, and to give away their freedom to feel like bigger people. It's Trump. It's just Trump. It's crazy.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And if I were giving someone who doesn't know Jack Kirby's work, like, and he did, like, you know, like, literally tens of thousands of pages of comics over 40 years. But it would be those Fourth World books, and then the other books of the 60s that are like outside the Fourth World cycle, but are also like, you know, really visionary works. But I mean, to me, that is the sort of the core Jack Kirby legacy. And in some ways, I mean, to circle back, like, it's a bit disappointing that Disney is so committed to, you know, this false narrative that they've created, because the other story, the actual story, is itself so interesting. And, you know, as we said, like, you know, like, not a total discredit to Stan Lee, like, in the sense of, you know, like, yeah, he himself did have, you know, we've been critical of many aspects of him, but, you know, like, he did collaborate with Kirby and did bring much to the table and did, in fact, help popularize Kirby in a way that, you know, like, I think one could argue that Kirby in the Raw and Ditko in the Raw are just, like, too much for the American mainstream. Like, it's a little bit too much. You know, he found a way of building a bridge to readers to help them assimilate this very radical body of work. But it's a great story. I mean, it's a great story. The real story is a great story. And it's so disappointing that, you know, like, for various economic reasons, they prefer to go with the fake story.
Yeah. I mean, I think we, you know, we're both big fans of Abraham Josephine Reisman's Stan Lee biography, which came out a couple years ago. I had her on my podcast then to talk about it. The book is fantastic. And, you know, a lot of people who are Stan Lee hardcore myth believers felt like it was, you know, hostile because it dared to point out anything that was untrue about Stan's story. But it's truly not. It is empathetic to the challenges and world that Stan came from and recognizes the ways in which he was a great innovator. And when people are unable to view inspiring historical figures in three-dimensional ways, that destroys a historical record. It's untrue, and it makes for less interesting understanding of the world. Like, I really do recommend folks check out her book if they want to really understand Stan Lee and that whole period at Marvel. I mean, there's so much. Listen, I hadn't read other biographies of Stan Lee before, but I was very familiar with Stan Lee's history. And I got so much out of reading Abraham Josephine Reisman's book that I didn't know coming into it.
Yeah, no, I'm going to link to that book. And it is the best book about Stan Lee and really the best book about sort of the Marvel comics that's been done. I think there'll be future works. I hope someone writes a biography of Jack Kirby, because I think that's also...
We have Kirby, the King of Comics, but, like, I agree that I feel like there's more space that, and the graphic novel from a couple years ago, but, like, there's we need more. There's so many figures in comics that are fascinating and that we do not have good history of. Like, I, you know, I think, like, Larry Hama, who's still with us, is, like, clearly, like, the most interesting man in the world, and I'm still waiting for somebody to, like, interview. Yeah. Like, what your life? You were an actor on MASH. You invented G.I. Joe's characters. You were, like, the only person of color in the room, you know, and these comics companies for years. Like, what was that all about?
That's right. And also, like, he had a toe in the underground comics. Yeah. It's like he was writing for comics where, like, you know, Robert Crumb and Trina Robbins were also appearing in, which is like, yeah, no, no. I mean, he'd be, like, a great figure for a profile and a feature-length interview. I think that they're, like, these great stories. And so it is disappointing. I'll also mention, you know, sort of closing out, there's, you know, like, DC and Marvel are two rival companies, and they're often in competition. And DC has their own documentary, which is available on HBO Max.
So bad.
I wouldn't recommend it as a good documentary. But I will note that as a slight difference, it acknowledges not all of the offenses that DC's done, but it does acknowledge that, you know, Siegel and Schuster, the creator of Superman, got a raw deal. It acknowledges that Bill Finger, the co-creator of Batman, you know, got a raw deal, both in terms of, you know, not getting ownership of the character and not being even getting credit for the character.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, like, I just point that out as, overall, the DC documentary is not good, but it is a corporate, and it is exactly corporate propaganda in the way that the Stan Lee documentary is, but it's a corporate propaganda that is, you know, on a few key points, a little bit more honest. So it's possible, right? Like, it is actually possible. I bring that up just to underscore, you know, like, the decision that was made by Disney to put out something that is so, like, flagrantly untrue. Like, that is, like, a choice that they made, and they didn't have to do that.
No, they minimized, like, even if you want to believe that the work behind of creating the Fantastic Four or the Hulk was 50-50, they did not even present it like 50-50. They just literally were like, Stan had ideas and he told Jack what to draw. It's just worse than you could imagine as far as lying. And, you know, I mean, it discredits your ability to take them seriously about Stan's real achievements. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. So on that note, I want to thank you once again for appearing on. I will link to the Graphic Policy Radio podcast, which if people enjoy this conversation, that I think many of you will have, I'd really encourage that for a listening experience where you can both get popular culture and good politics, one nice space. So again, thank you for appearing on.
Thank you for having me. It's really a lot of fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced. From the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beet brand for heart health support, the new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to radiobeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's radiobeats.com, code DEAL.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.